Thank you all for coming on this wild and woolly, wintry, snowy night. The first snow of the season, that's a special thing. It's all so fresh, you know, and pure. How do we maintain it, though, you know? How do we maintain that freshness and pureness as the soot starts to build and dig ourselves into everyday life? How do we practice mindfulness and compassion and bring it into our daily living? Something that I've been wondering about for a long time. And I've been practicing Zen since the early 70s and began a kind of child counseling just the year after that. So I've been involved in Buddhist practice and psychotherapy in one form or another for over 40 years. Starting in 2006, 2007, I began with colleagues and friends working with returning service members and veterans and their families, children, and also their care providers. And that followed in a series of other related projects I've done with people who've suffered and experienced some trauma in different settings, trying to see what that interplay of Buddhism and Western psychology looks like in terms of healing, transforming trauma, and increasing well-being. I learned a great deal. I had done work with just about everybody and anybody and any problem or difficulty. I'd probably seen it. I learned a great deal from this population, and truth be told, I completely fell in love with this group of people. My dad was a World War II veteran, and I realized how much his service had played in my life after I got involved with the Coming Home Project. I realized how being a kid of war had sensitized me. Lest you be concerned that this is just going to be a grim talk, it's also a talk full of hope and change and joy and finding the joy that's inherent in our being human in the midst of trauma. And I don't know what you think, but I think learning how to hold the joy and the sorrows in a impartial way as they come, not getting too bent out of shape by either. And when we do, knowing how to work with that, that's part of becoming a real human being, learning to accept and work with the joys and the sorrows. In Buddhism, of course, we address suffering from a number of different perspectives, but there's precious little in classical Buddhism, more in some contemporary teachings, about trauma, which is a very important subset of suffering, and very often, although not always, is not self-created. Like a lot of suffering is sort of self-created, but cumulative trauma often is not. And so some of the things I'm going to describe about war, what I've learned about it from a couple thousand veterans and family members and care providers, also applies to other kinds of trauma, and you may notice some of the connections as I speak, but I'm going to focus on war trauma. I have found war to be a great teacher, if we can learn from it, just like all suffering. If we can learn something, if we can redeem that experience, no matter how horrific it is. But the problem is that, again, I'm going to focus on war trauma. War trauma is a double whammy. You can't do with it, and you can't do without it. There's something about impactful, cumulative war trauma that's like a bondo, that's like a glue. There's a release of adrenaline, there's a sense of aliveness. It's hard to separate from and really observe it, really talk about it, really. You can't do, trauma can't do with it, can't do without it. Can't do with it because we don't, because that trauma not only creates horrific, unprocessable experiences, but it dismantles our ability to reflect on them. Our ability to think, to reason, to feel. It even can hijack our ability to dream and integrate experiences as our dream work is set up to do and help us do. So if those capacities needed to learn from the trauma are dismantled, that is a double whammy. Can't live without it. It's such an adrenaline rush. That's why so many guys and women can't wait till they get back into theater, because there's just something so compelling about it. It's not always healthy. And when folks come home, we'll do lots of high-risk activities, often risk their lives, often indirectly take their lives, just trying to recapture some of that over-amped feeling, the feeling of aliveness, which is our human inheritance. Now, we try to help people recapture that experience of aliveness in the civilian world so they can reclaim that human capacity for aliveness as one great noble quality without having to be scared to death or risk death. So I want to share with you some of the voices that I've heard, some of the stories that I've heard, some of the anguish of these folks or veterans and families, but also what I've learned about repair, redemption, acceptance, and transformation. A process that I've come to call turning ghosts into ancestors. A ghost is something that haunts, that colonizes the present, that basically robs us of the present. We're basically reliving something from the past, but we don't know that it's the past. It's just taking up the whole present screen. We can't think about the future because it's just one screen. But I've learned that veterans and their family members can transform these ghosts into ancestors or usable memories, and memories that can be thought about, that can serve as the basis for learning from experience and conducting oneself in the rest of one's life. And if they can do it, then so can we do it. We can do it too. And this is a premise of our work at Coming Home Project, that war trauma affects everybody in our society, whether we know it or not, whether we experience it or not. It just works that way in a very mysterious way, and I'm not going to get wah-wah on you, I promise you. But listen for just a moment to suspend, you know, your ideas of time and space. What I've learned is that war trauma is like an IED blast. You understand an IED blast? It's an improvised explosive device, signature weapon of these last two wars, which are turning into a season of endless war. And these devices don't just spew shrapnel and other particles that hurt you, but they have tremendous concussive power. They can bring down buildings at a long distance. And I came to see one day, amazingly, that war trauma is just like an IED blast, that it spreads omnidirectionally, that's to say, all over, instantaneously reaching all of us. I actually think this is true. Plus, I think it's a useful model to have, because we know that war trauma doesn't just affect the veteran within his skin or her skin. It affects their spouse, their partner, their parents who are worrying about them, their kids, their siblings, their uncles, aunties, grandparents, people who care about them. It affects not only whole families, but communities. It affects our Congress, which has to deal with these costs of war, face them or neglect them. It affects our policymakers. It affects our leaders. And unless we're aware of the impacts of trauma, what will happen is that it'll dismantle connections. Trauma dismantles all of these connections. So the connections that we assume between our body, our mind, our heart, trauma dismantles those. The connections within family members, trauma can dismantle those. So when veterans come home, they're bonded to whom? They're bonded to their buddies. And they come and meet their families, and their families have changed. Their families observe them, and often it's sort of like, well, who did you bring me back? You didn't bring me back the guy or the woman that I sent off. How do you reconnect those broken connections? Or the connections between veterans and their communities? I didn't understand for a while why veterans of these recent conflicts felt similarly to how Vietnam veterans felt when they came back, and Vietnam veterans would be spit on and called baby killers, and that doesn't routinely happen at all for this generation of veterans who are held in the hearts of many of us who are able to separate the war from the warrior. But think about it for a moment. You come home, and maybe you were just in the war zone 36 hours before, maybe 48 hours before. Certainly 72 hours before is not uncommon for some guardsmen or reservists, and they're sort of dropped back into their life, not on base, not with their buddies. And you can imagine how surreal the world would look. Like, there's no signs of war, there's no signs of shared sacrifice. It's a very alienating feeling. I came to understand it as I listened over and over again. And then you look at the fractures and the disconnects in our veteran service organizations. Now, if any of you are here who work in the VA, who work in nonprofit world, work in DOD, my heart goes out to you. I love you. But let's face it, many of these systems are broken. They are so dysfunctional, and they're crazy-making. And they are impacted by the trauma of working with the aftershocks of war, but many of them are not aware of it. And the response to it is really bad and sometimes even malevolent, dishonest, causes a lot more trauma. And then we have our leaders who are impacted as well, dissociating, misjudging, reacting like cowboys. I won't go there, don't have to go there. But I want to paint a picture in which trauma is affecting everybody, and it's breaking connectedness. Connectedness heals. Isolation, fragmentation does not. That's why if we are in a kind of dissociative trance, we're in war right now, aren't we? We are, but we haven't declared it. That's a kind of crazy-making thing. So just like there's something we call the trance of everyday life that we have to wake up from, there's a sort of dissociative trance that we can get caught up in. Now, with veterans, they've got to complete the mission. So what happens is they push ahead. And what happens to the overwhelming experiences that they're going through? They sort of recede to the background. They kind of go underground. But one of the amazing things I learned, and then I want to share some examples and bring this to life, put some flesh and blood on these ideas. But one of the things I learned is that the studies and the modalities that are being developed to eliminate post-traumatic memories, I think do a disservice. Can you imagine that if you never had access to a post-traumatic memory? What I finally learned was revolutionary to me, is that post-traumatic stress residues are sitting there in our mind-body waiting for the right environment to represent themselves. A safe environment, an unconditionally welcoming, accepting environment. And this is experienced physically, not just mentally. When somebody feels safe, unconditionally accepted, post-traumatic stress starts to peek its nose out. Say, like a little turtle, sticks its head out a little bit, waiting to see how far it can come out. This is not conscious. I've seen it happen hundreds of times. It's beneath the threshold of consciousness. So if you steal the capacity to have bad memories or a bad dream, you're stealing the capacity for transformation and learning and growth, even though it brings such tremendous anguish with it. So at Coming Home Project, we learned a great deal about how to construct an environment of safety and unconditional compassion in which this very thing could happen. And I'll talk in a moment about this process that unfolds, transformative process called turning ghosts into ancestors and the steps along the way. But let's hear from some real people first. The first real person we heard from at a Coming Home Project retreat for families, we were about 40 people in the room, a room very much like this at First Congregational Church in Berkeley in early 2007. We had about 40, 45 people from all across the country, some of them facilitators, plus myself, a number of kids, some young kids, and we gathered for the first Coming Home Project retreat. A lot of bustling, a lot of getting to know each other. I invite people to sit in a circle, to take a moment of silence, to remember those who couldn't share this with us, for whatever reason that might be. Within moments, there's a fairly profound silence. And after 15 seconds, maybe 20 seconds, Ben, a 2.5-year-old boy who's playing on the outskirts of this circle, says to his playmate, Isaiah, and they're both military kids from different families, we hear him, the first words, he said, "My daddy died in Iraq." Everyone heard it. This set the tone for our entire retreat, I think for all of our Coming Home Project retreats. Something about that quality of silence just felt safe enough for Ben to say something that he knew. Now, it turned out, we learned in short order, that Michael, who was a captain in the Army, had come home and after 6 months had actually killed himself. And his wife, Stephanie, who was also a captain in the Army, had been ostracized from her church, which thought that suicide was a sin, and had come looking for a fellowship to meet people, to talk about her experiences, to connect with other spouses, to talk about the loss, to feel just the camaraderie that she knew when she was in the service, and that Michael felt when he was in the service. And so as soon as she let others know what had happened to her, during the next break, spouses swarmed next to her and they set up times to visit. And before she knew it, she had a network. And after the retreat, she's traveling around the country using the death benefits, Michael's death benefits, to connect with these other spouses. That's an example of how community works. When people would ask me, "Well, you're doing these retreats, Joe, and I hear they're pretty good. What do you do? Do you do mindfulness? Is that, why do they work?" And I just scratched my head, and two words came to mind. One, and neither was very sexy. It wasn't very evidence-based at that time. It wasn't the newest and the greatest and the coolest, but one was safety, and the other was community. Given half a chance, we discovered that veterans and their kids wanted nothing more than to connect with one another. And it is out of that connection that they could allow a healing process to develop. And we were providing an environment for just that to happen. I cannot tell you, it sounds so simple, but you must stop and realize how powerful this sense of community is. I was talking with a friend over dinner about a series of articles that have appeared in the New York Times by Dave Phillips. They're just beautiful articles beginning last year on the regiment of Marines called the 2-7, who's had very high rates of suicide. And he conveys their story. And in all of their stories, they say the same thing. I felt so isolated. I felt so hopeless. And so what did these guys do? They were guys. What did they do? VA didn't help very much. Sometimes was harmful. Counterproductive, let's put it that way. Everything they turned to didn't work. They turned toward one another to develop, you know, their sense of camaraderie. But they couldn't sustain it in the way that we could do at a retreat. It's as clear as day that what they're doing is seeking this sense of safety and community, belonging and trust. all the research that's done on suicide, sometimes we forget that one of the research results showed that a sense of belonging to one's unit could be somewhat inoculating against suicide within that unit. So this quality of belonging, so important, belonging and safety. I'll give you another story that demonstrates, I think, how I felt like we were doing something, we were making connections, and people were partaking of them. Again, this is from the very first retreat. Prior to going into the room and sitting down together, people were mingling outside. And two of the guys who were mingling had massive head injuries. One was a Marine and one was an enlisted Army guy. One was blown up in an IED blast, Rory, and lost three of his buddies and most of his brain and his right eye. And the other guy, Kenny, was a little bit older with a family, and a bullet had bounced around in his Humvee, entered his head and gotten out his neck. And neither of them could see very well, but their family members wanted them to meet each other because their injuries were kind of similar. And so here were their handlers, their family members. I'm looking at this from about 30 paces. Their handlers are moving them closer and closer together, and then Rory and Kenny can't see each other. So they go to within about like 5 inches of one another, and you know that's way inside the personal space. But they wanted to see each other. And then, I'm watching this from 20 paces, and the tears just start coming. They take each other's hands completely spontaneously and say, "Can you feel my scar here? This is where the bullet went in. Oh, can you see the... You can't see the patch, but here, feel the patch over here. I got the patch on my eye. I lost the eye on that." And they're like primates, you know, sort of touching each other and guiding one another's hands over their wounds just so that the other could know them. This was what was so important. And it was just incredibly powerful to me. The tears just kept coming. They weren't telling all of their stories, right? But they were connecting in a very, very visceral way. And it is these kinds of connections that we found so healing. Let me tell you a little bit about our retreats and the components of the retreats, and then tell you a few more stories and work our way toward turning ghosts into ancestors. The four qualities that we realized we were cultivating in family members and veterans and also in ourselves through these programs were aliveness. The second element is bonding. The third is regulation. And the fourth is meaning and purpose. Aliveness I've spoken about. Bonding. Again, in the crucible of war, the threat of death is omnipresent. You bond with the guy next to you and the gal to the right of you and to the left of you, and that's who veterans tell us they fight for. Not for an ideology. Certainly, very rarely in this war. The stories that we hear is guys and women get over there, they may have gone over with a certain mission, but soon enough, they're fighting for the guy next to them and the guy to the right of them, and so that they can all get home safe. So when they come home, of course, it may look good and seem good from outside in the family relationships, but as I said before, many of those relationships have fractured. They don't know each other. There's a new normal that they can't even fathom. So we allow relationships to form, and out of the relationships and the connections between veterans, they start making similar connections with their family members. So a sense of bonding with people other than the buddies you were with in theater, expanding your kind of behavioral repertoire, if you will. And intimacy. I can't tell you how many veterans, have a partner. And one of the things that doesn't get talked about a whole lot is intimacy. And I'm talking emotional, but I'm also talking physical. Just physical, just touch, just affection. And then, of course, I'm also talking sex. And most folks don't want to talk about that, but one guy in a couples communication workshop finally sort of confessed that, you want me just to open up? It's like just to open up the faucet, it's all going to be there? You don't know that if I open up the let's just call it the sex faucet, you know what else is going to come out. I have no control over all the other feelings that are going to come out. So if I really open my heart to you, you're going to get a rush of a whole bunch of other stuff. That's why vets rarely talk about the details of what they've been through with their family members. The third element is regulation. Regulating emotions, developing what I call meditative muscle or emotional muscle, and a kind of hardiness so that we can feel somewhat confident that when strong emotions come, we can bear with the highs and the lows, and we won't capsize. And if we do capsize, well, then there are brothers and sisters around us who can help us get up, and we may have some practices we can turn to help us reconstellate. Regulation, emotional regulation, is so key. What we found is that this emotional regulation is cultivated not just from mindfulness practice, which we know now from research, or from Qigong, but from the community itself. That's to say, right brain to right brain, we are already regulating one another. And in the small groups and in the large groups who met and in the natural settings we were a part of, guys and women tell us, oh, I just got here and I'm sitting in the down by the stream. I can feel myself ramping down. These are the words they use. I'm ramping down. I don't know why I feel relaxed. I'm not used to it. What's going to happen if I do it too much? But they start to feel it. So developing regulation capacities makes trauma can't live with it, can't live without it. It helps the can't live with it part. You learn to be able to live with it. And the fourth element is meaning and purpose. Really key. You read these Dave Phillips articles on the 2-7 Marines and the epidemic of suicides within their unit. The guys he interviews talk about it. I came back with no sense of purpose, no sense of meaning. Sometimes this can take on a vocational sense. You know, what am I here in the world to do? I was doing a job that was so compelling, so exciting, seemed so important, and now I'm flipping burgers. You know, it's got to be more than this. And it can be spiritual sometimes. It can be my whole assumptive world. All the things I take for granted were shattered. I saw people act in ways I never thought were possible. I may have done things that clashed directly with my own internal philosophy of what's right and wrong. I may have not been able to do things and lost people because, not from my fault, but just because I wasn't able to do it. So there's a kind of suffering that people bring back that's very profound. I'll talk about it in a moment. Some people call it moral injuries. Some don't agree with that term, moral, but very profound wound that's not just a simple anxiety disorder with a set of symptoms, you know, PTSD symptoms. It goes deeper than that. So meaning and purpose, regulation, bonding, aliveness. Jeremy was a Marine who was on a kayak trip that we took. This was in Northern California across Heart's Desire Beach. I don't know if you know Tomales Bay near Inverness. It's a very beautiful bay. And we were kayaking, of all places, to Heart's Desire Beach to have lunch and then to kayak back. Well, on the way back, as you can imagine, guys and women with their family groups, they organized a little impromptu race. They're paddling to see who could get back there first. Jeremy got there first with his wife, and he exclaimed as he lifted the oar up, "Joe, I'm so high." And I said, "Yeah, that's the good high, Jeremy. That's the good high." So that was one of the kinds of experiences we made possible for veterans, an experience of exhilaration that's not tied into the terror of death. It may look and feel the same, but it's completely different. The second kind of program we had was small support groups. Male vets met with male vets, women with women vets, kids with kids, partners and spouses and parents and so on. So they felt like they were among their own kind, where they didn't have to just start from scratch and talk to someone who didn't know where they were coming from. The third element was wellness practices, qigong, yoga, meditation. The fourth element, expressive arts, journaling, painting, drawing, dancing, singing, poetry. And the fifth element, secular ritual. We did some amazing rituals between kids and adults to have them listen to one another's experience so kids could really have a voice. Adults would listen to their experience, and then adults could get to hear the kids' experience. Kids could get to actually hear the adults' experience. So those are the four qualities, the five activities. I think there are two kinds of post-traumatic stress, but they intersect and they're difficult to separate out. One is the cluster of anxiety-related symptoms that we know. They're in the DSM manual. Many of us have experienced it. Say, I experienced a number of these during the earthquake in San Francisco, 1989. We have a trauma. Eventually, it gets extinguished, and those things that trigger us lose their power to continue to trigger us. That would be a very simple kind of a trauma. Vets don't experience it simply. Some of these symptoms can be very powerful, like insomnia, going from 0 to 60 and with one's anger very quickly, inability to modulate emotions. But I found that guys and women find it much easier to talk about that kind of PTSD than they do to talk about these other kinds of wounds that some people use moral injuries to as a name for them. Let me give you an example of 15 male vets sitting in a small group with me and my buddy Nathan, who's a young Iraqi vet who became a social worker. They were comparing notes on how fast they went from 0 to 60. And one said, I go from 0 to 60 in 10 seconds. Oh, my wife can't stand it. And the other one said, yeah, I go from 0 to 60 in 6 seconds. My wife can't stand it, and my kids can't stand it. The next one said, I go from 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, and my dog can't stand it. And you know, here they are talking about these post-traumatic stress symptoms. It's not that hard to access. It's not that hard to access the impacts these symptoms have on those around them. It's actually, I shouldn't say not so hard, because it can be very hard, but there are ways to address this problem. Yoga, meditation, stories, journaling has very good results with these kinds of dysregulation disorders. I call it, the D in that kind of PTSD is not disorder, but is dysregulation. But the other kind of PTSD involves the haunting that I was telling you about. And let me give you an example of the haunting. Bob Rodriguez was a CB. CBs build bases. They're the advanced team. They set up all the complexes out of which we conduct our military operations in theater. And Bob was on guard duty one night, just outside the wire, just outside a forward operating base, which he and his buddies had constructed. And there was an event that happened. And he'd been processing this event for 5 years. Every night, he would wake up in a cold sweat with what some people would call a nightmare, but I don't think it was a nightmare. I call it a night visitation. Certainly wasn't a dream. It's a visitation of some traumatic memory that seizes you by the throat and doesn't let you go. And it basically had hijacked his sleep, his well-being, every single night for 5 years. And I believed him. So here's what he would wake up to. He would wake up to this phantasmagoric vision of looking through the sights of a rifle and seeing the face of an Iraqi boy who he had pointed his rifle at. This is a true story, he had pointed his rifle at. But in this phantasmagoric vision, he was about to pull the trigger, and as soon as he started depressing the trigger, the faces of his own twin boys would pop up into the sights. And he would be frozen because he'd be terrified that if he pulled the trigger, it could just be like he's killing his own sons. But if he didn't pull the trigger, it was like he was jeopardizing the safety of his men. And it was like a Sophie's choice. And he'd wake up in this cold sweat every night for 5 years. Can you imagine that? Not sleeping? So this is the kind of haunting that I was talking to you about. Now, it took Bob a long time to reach the point where he could share this. But when he did share it, and when he experienced the response of the group, something shifted inside of him. It was just palpable. I'll give you one more example, and then we'll go into the process of how this works, turning ghosts into ancestors, what I've observed. There's a guy I'll call Arnold. He's a Filipino-American guy who was a medic. And he also had to kill somebody. And it tortured him that as a medic, he had to kill a kid who was about to throw a grenade into a Humvee. But medics are trained to use guns, and he was protecting his unit. And everybody would tell him, well, you know, you've protected us, you saved us, it's a good thing. He never felt it was a good thing. His sense of identity was so wrapped around his being a healer that he knew all these other things that people had been telling him, trying to help him, trying to fix him, trying to tell him, don't be so hard on yourself. I mean, you can imagine how many people for how long tried to make him feel better. It made him feel worse. He had been blown up quite a few times by IED blasts, but he said this pain was the biggest pain. And so one day, after he had gotten home, he was so angry that anger was one of the responses to this deep pain inside. He whacked his kid, his teenage kid, and he felt so ashamed of himself that he left the house. Well, in the middle of the veterans group that he was a part of, he started to tell this story, and then he became so ashamed, so frightened of exposing himself and the awful feelings he felt about himself. He dashed out of the room, and we had to send someone after him and talk him into coming back into the room. Finally, bit by bit, he was able to discuss what had happened, these terrible conflicts that he felt. And at the end of the retreat, his son, who he hadn't seen for like 40 days, I think, he'd been living outside of the house for about a month and a half. As part of our closing circle, he went up to his son and gave him a big hug. And it was just incredible to see. It was just so moving. But this was part of this process that I'm talking about, of how these traumatic experiences are healed. They're not eliminated, but they're changed in their nature and how they're encoded, how they're experienced, how they function within us to guide us forward rather than to haunt us, hijack our lives. So here are the steps. There are a lot of steps, and they all start with an R for some strange reason. It starts with regulation, because most of the vets and family members who come to us have nervous systems that are dysregulated. That means that they're not able to feel confident in regulating the highs and lows of their emotional experience. And there's a lot of glitches to that. As I told you before, from the time they arrive at the retreat, nature is helping them regulate. The birds, the stars at night, talking with their fellow vets into the night. They're sharing stories. They're regulating one another. Just the palpable human presence of one another, inclining our minds and hearts in the direction of healing, is very regulating, very safety-inducing. We feel that when we sit in meditation with others. We feel the support of the community. How much more veterans feel sitting in support with their own who've been through similar experiences. So regulation is already happening whether we're meditating or not. It's the compassionate activity of what I like to call the beloved community. It was just Martin Luther King's birthday, so I'll call it the beloved community. And the second is recognition. A lot of guys and women come in thinking that they're crazy, that it's just them. And this sense of being crazy makes things way worse than it already is. For when they're sitting in a small support group and they hear someone begin to tell their story, it's not unusual for someone to say to themselves, holy crap, that's my experience. How could they be having that experience? I thought I was the only one in the whole world, and I thought I was alone and crazy. And then the next one shares another element of your experience, and then you feel, no one jumped in to interrupt them. Nobody jumped in to fix them. Nobody jumped in to tell them that they were getting it wrong, or that they were a real jerk, or worse, that they were a weak soldier or disloyal. Nobody did any of that. They just listened with an open heart, welcomed in a non-judgmental way. So someone decides, I can take a risk. That's the third R word. Regulate, recognize risk. It happens beneath the threshold of consciousness. Nobody is thinking this to themselves. I am extrapolating the process, which I found very, very robust. Hundreds of times. Someone takes a risk. They put their foot into the water. Nobody else got their nose cut off. I'll try. See how deep the water is. And if they really start to put their feet in the water, if they take that risk, they start to re-experience their trauma. With full emotional accompaniment, often, gradually, but with full emotional accompaniment, whatever it was. And that full emotional accompaniment often includes a tremendous amount of self-loathing, tremendous amount of self-blame, guilt, shame, and at the bottom of all of it, a kind of helpless rage, an unspeakable helplessness. And it's easier, isn't it? Just like kids who have magical thinking, it's easier to blame yourself than to allow yourself to have this completely terrifying experience of helplessness, of rage, that I couldn't do anything. I think that's fundamentally what's at the heart, this despairing, helpless feeling. But it's a lot of self-loathing. And so people tell the story of their experience with their emotional accompaniment, but there's a recontextualization. There's a reauthoring of that experience that happens, that's sponsored by the non-judgmental, loving, empathic response of their brothers and sisters. Something shifts, their heart cracks open, not really believing that it's possible that somebody didn't jump down their throat, didn't call them all kinds of names, but instead is looking at them with loving eyes, not trying to fix them, completely accepting, just as they are, maybe going up and just putting a hand on a shoulder, and that's it. No tissues, no thrusting tissues, which gives the message, grief is not okay. The heart cracks open. There's a tremendous flood of grief, of loss, of powerlessness. And with that, it's not just a catharsis, but with that, the trauma is encoded into their philosophy of living in a different key. It's no longer a shameful thing that they can't talk to somebody about. It's a memory. It's held and contained in the loving, attentive embrace of their fellow veterans and family members, the beloved community. And there is a sense now that this is my trauma. This is the other thing. There's a reauthoring of it. If you read about the 27 Marines, they all of them say, and then this thing happened, and another buddy of mine killed himself, and it was such a shock, and I couldn't believe it. It's like an alien thing had it hit them upside the head and lodged in them. It's completely alien. But if you go through this process of turning ghosts into ancestors, this becomes your trauma. You're authoring your trauma. You're left with a memory, and that memory can be a source of wisdom. This happened. I can learn from that. I can recall it. It can be an object lesson for me going forward. That's why we call it turning ghosts into ancestors. And I'll close and open for some questions in just a moment with this little vignette, which was confirmed in its importance. I always knew it was important, but it's a playful vignette. It's a joyful vignette. So I thought, it's not hard evidence. It's too joyful. But I was at this conference with Bessel van der Kolk. I don't know if you know this guy. He's like, He's like a world-renowned expert. And we were talking about trauma, and he said, you know, Joe, a lot of people talk about, you know, that they transform, they heal their trauma, this and that. He says, I want to see it. I want to see how they move. I want to see what they do. There's some way in which, because of his knowledge of the brain and all this stuff, that there's something, it has to translate into the motoric system. How does this translate? And we've seen these amazing nonverbal changes in people's physiognomy from the time they come to the time they leave. However, in this vignette, it was just unbelievable. This guy Arnold not only went up motorically and hugged his son, and everybody's cheering and crying at the same time. That's one example. But later, along with some other buddies who he had met at the retreat, who had also been blown up a few times and had lots of physical injuries, but those didn't bother them nearly as much as the other kinds of wounds that I've been discussing with you tonight. A number of these guys, one after the other, as we put on the music, we usually do a kind of dance time in the last evening of the retreat. These guys who could barely walk, a number of them got up with their canes and one with their crutches, and they grabbed their old ladies and they pulled them out to the dance floor, and they did a kind of do-si-do out on the dance floor. And everyone watched it, and everybody saw it, that some burden had lifted from their shoulders. Maybe not permanently. Our research shows that it did last 30 to 60 days. That's all we had the funding to demonstrate. 30 to 60 days was still incredibly strong and consistent. But to see these guys, you know, who'd come in looking one way and gone through this process and ended up dancing, celebrating their lives, being able to hold the joy along with the helpless tragedy that they had been through. This is incredibly inspiring for me. So I think I'm going to stop there. And thank you so much for your attentive listening. And I'd love to take a couple of questions if you have about any aspect of this, or a brief comment if you want to make it.
Hi. When the vets are talking about their experiences, do you find that it's critical that they're able to identify sort of a specific instance or a specific trauma that they can work through, or can they speak to sort of a general sense of trauma?
I can go back and forth. The important thing is not to insist that it be any which way, but just that once the relational conditions have been internalized, and as the neuroscientist Steve Porges says, that the whole physiology is responding to the experience of safety beneath the threshold of consciousness. Once that is starting to happen, and we can see the signs of that happening, we let that unfold as it will. We don't care if it's a specific or a non-specific. It's just, you know, the channel is open. And it's going to go where it needs to go, exactly where it needs to go. Sometimes it's incredibly specific, like in the examples that I've given you tonight. Sometimes it stays pretty general, and then maybe it'll get specific later on. But it's more of a process than a particular kind of outcome that we're looking for. Anybody else?
I have one question.
Yeah, please.
Interesting to be here in a session where you talk about suicide so often. I had the fortune to have my father commit suicide when I was very little.
I'm very
and
sorry.
I have often asked different people from different religions how they view it, because being originally Catholic, it is a punishment, right? You're going to be punished. And my curiosity for you is, how do you view it as a Zen Buddhist? How do you view the soul and the energy and, you know, the spirit of these people that in such agony do that? Do you believe they still be punished beyond all the agony they already had in life?
Well, I don't think anyone who suffered war trauma should be punished, number one. Suicide is an awful tragedy. It leaves the survivors with a terrible experience to process, again, of helplessness, of powerlessness, at not being able to reach the person who ended their life. It may also leave the survivor with a lot of anger at the person for not having given them a chance to help them. And mostly in reading these stories, and also, by the way, the stories at vets at our retreats. I'm talking about the stories in the New York Times articles about the 2-7 Marines. But we had a number of stories that vets would tell us, and they'd never told anybody else that they had tried to kill themselves. They'd been unsuccessful, so they didn't have to tell anybody. Or they'd never told anybody that they were going to commit suicide. And so they felt safe enough to tell all of this. But I think suicide is just a tragic loss of life, and we're trying to study it. There are people who are trying to understand what happens. We don't really understand it well. I think it is preventable, and I think the kind of programs, not just our program, but similar kinds of programs, have a very good track record in the ways that I just described to you of preventing suicide, if they were only funded to the degree that they need to be funded. I don't think you can ever keep someone who's determined from committing suicide to doing so. But I think there's, at the root of many who take their own lives, is a tremendous sense of despair at things ever changing. And so I think that environments that connect people, that repair broken connections that I've been talking about, give people hope and give people an environment in which they can share their despair. And I think suicide can be prevented to a much greater degree than it is being now. So I'm not responding from a cosmological or a religious perspective, but those are my thoughts. Thank you. Anybody else? A couple in the back?
Thanks for your talk. Sure. You were talking about the importance of making sense of or finding meaning in or learning from one's experience.
Sure.
And I'm interested to know, particularly for the people whose experiences prompt a spiritual crisis, what kinds of things you've seen that they're able to take from their experience or learn from it that help them heal?
Well, I think the first thing that I've noticed that people, and Kenny, the Marine Master Sergeant who I talked about before, who connected with Rory, he had a spiritual crisis. It took this shape for him. He went back home to Fort Pendleton, and along with his wife, Tonya, they got back with their kids. He was getting patched up. And I went to visit them and stay over one evening. And I saw the next morning on Sunday that he wasn't going to church. And I said, why not? Because I wanted to accompany them to church just to kind of connect with their tradition. And he said, well, I don't want to really talk about it. So I said, well, it's okay. It's me. I mean, you can. And so after the others left, he finally said, look, I got nothing against him. And I figured out who he was talking about. You know, I got nothing against him. In fact, I was very devout. But I have some questions now because I wasn't doing anything bad. I was just driving my car around, bringing back this Humvee to fix it. Didn't kill anybody. And yet this bullet entered in there, and he had this why me question. Why, God, why hast thou forsaken me? Given his religion of origin, this is how he was processing it. And there was a tremendous feeling of betrayal. And I find in examples like this, you know, crises of faith or spiritual crises, this is only one form they can take, but it's a live form. Is being a Buddhist, I have to be very ecumenical and leave him a lot of room to work things out for himself, to work out the feeling of betrayal, to shake his fist at him or her, or whatever we call it, you know, as much as he needs to, and to still be welcomed and affirmed as he finds his new path along the way. He reconstructs his religious belief. And I think that all too often, and we see this in the military a lot, there's a lot of fanatical religious chaplains. They're not all that way, by a long shot. My best friends are chaplains. But there's a number who can inadvertently make people feel really guilty, you know, that they're ye of little faith kind of thing. If you only had come, and now you can finally come to Jesus and everything will be saved. And it's a dreadful mistake. Spiritual crises, crises of faith, you need to find your way with the support of the community. And I think, you know, the kinds of connections that happen at programs like our retreat really help, because you can develop a sense of inner cohesiveness again through meditation practice, through yoga, getting in touch with your body again, reconnecting with friends. There's a phrase I like to use, reweaving the connective tissue that kind of held you together. And then eventually, that will take shape for him into some kind of religious belief. I know it will, because he's a religious guy. But you've got to suspend trying to bring him to God so he can find his way through the valley of the shadow of death, really. Maybe one more question?
Please. Hi, thank you so much. I was just wondering if there was a specific style or technique of meditation that you would teach veterans that, you know, had that grief and trauma really present, that might have either never meditated before or just are really unable to sit, and, you know, low patience, low tolerance for thoughts.
Oh, yeah.
If there was kind of a, you know, there's so many different meditation techniques that we practice here.
It's a great question. It's kind of a long answer, but I'll give the short version. Because my learning curve has been very steep when it comes to this. The first time I introduced meditation into the group, two people got up and left. And one felt that it was a threat to her own religion. In fact, it was Stephanie who had been ostracized from her church. And she wanted another practice. And when it was made available, she felt she was being disloyal to her church. I was trying to convert her to Buddhism, if you can imagine. So that's one particular pitfall I learned. And Rory, who I told you about, the young vet, who had half of his brain rebuilt, he ducked out because, as he told me later, when I was encouraging him to pay attention to bodily sensations, he told me, yeah, Joe, I was just hearing all this crunching in my head. And it didn't sound too good, so I figured I'd stop it. Well, who would want crunching sounds in your head? I mean, I don't know what it is. He's got ceramic filler in there. I mean, who knows what happens when he tries to get the synapses going. So I learned I had to customize, and I had to do walking meditation with some folks, breath counting or mantra type of work rather than mindful awareness of the body in a less structured way. I learned a number of things, so I'm happy to share with you a little bit after, but it needs to be adjusted really to each particular person when possible. Also, Qigong is a very powerful practice because it's moving, and yet it has awareness in movement and energy, all those three elements, and it's very, people like it a lot, vets like it a lot. So moving meditation, Qigong, or the Thich Nhat Hanh style, which I teach, walking meditation outside, is really a treatment of choice over sitting meditation for many. Okay. Well, it's just a pleasure. Thank you for coming on this cold evening and listening to a grim topic, but that has a lot of hope and joy and healing in it. I hope you've heard that as well. Well, thank you very much.